I'm Lisa Davis. Welcome to It's Your Health on Thinking Out Loud on WUML 91.5 FM. October is National Sensory Awareness Month, and I have once again joined forces with the fantastic Marla Rothfish, who works with Future Horizons, a world leader in books, DVDs, and conferences on autism and Asperger's syndrome, to bring me some very special guests this month. And joining us today to kick off the three-show series is Paula Akia, an occupational therapist who has worked with adults and children in clinical, educational, home, and community-based settings. She was a founding executive director of Giant Steps in Toronto and directs IKEA Pediatric Occupational Therapy, which serves families with children who have special needs. Paula co-authored Building Bridges Through Sensory Integration, which is a fantastic book. And Paula, I want to welcome you to It's Your Health on Thinking Out Loud on WUML 91.5 FM.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Now, Paula, for people who aren't familiar, what is SPD?
SPD is the acronym for sensory processing disorder, and it's a disorder that describes the difficulty of the nervous system to take information in from within your own body and also from within the environment, and processing it and making sense of it so that you can use it to plan your responses to the environment.
And I know that there are folks who are sensory defensive. And interestingly enough, my mother was extraordinarily sensory defensive. But then there's also kids who are sensory seekers, if you can tell, and adults, you can tell us about that. And also ones that tend to, maybe they'll touch something hot and really not notice it right away. So they're less sensitive.
You're absolutely right. There's a taxonomy that's being used that was developed by Dr. Lucy Miller in Colorado. And she's divided the sensory processing disorders into three main categories. The first is a sensory modulation disorder, and you've done a great job giving three great examples of that. One is sensory over-responsivity, and that's when the nervous system has an over-responsive reaction to sensation, and even little bits of sensation can create a big response. You can have sensory under-responsivity, where you don't even really notice the sensation. So the most common example of that, in my practice anyway, is children who are very focused and parents will be calling them and they don't register that their name is being called in the environment until the person is very close to them or the sound is very loud. And for these children, safety is a big concern, especially if they're not constantly in touch with their bodies and they're not picking up things like hot temperatures or sharp edges, etc. So have to really work through the environment to help children like that to be safe. And then there's sensory seekers. And sensory seekers they're children that seem to be constantly looking for something that's new. Every new input, whatever sensory system it comes from, calls their attention. And they have a hard time staying focused on one activity. Their nervous system seems to be tuned into anything that's different. And then the second main category is called sensory discrimination disorder. And this is where the nervous system has having a hard time attaching the correct meaning to the sensation that it's receiving. So one of the examples of sensory discrimination disorder would be synesthesia. And that's where people are hearing colors or they're seeing taste.
My husband has that, by the way.
You know, it's more common than we than people actually know. In some research studies, it's been noted to be as much as 5% of the general population.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so what happens, it's pretty neat. I've read a few accounts of people with synesthesia, and of course, you don't know that you're perceiving the world any differently than anyone else until you start describing how that sunset tastes. You know, and then the person you're describing it to will say, "What are you talking about?"
Yeah.
And that's when you really, you know, you realize that it's you're perceiving it a little differently.
Yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
I think this is what a lot of artists actually experience, which enables them to see things from a different perspective.
Yes, my husband's an artist and a writer, and it's funny. My best friend, I'm seen to be attracted to artistic people. he also writes and is very artistic. And he said he was at a meeting at work, and somehow that came up. I don't know. And he said everyone looked at him like he was an alien, you know, from outer space. Like they had. I said, didn't they ask you? They said no. They basically just went, oh wow, and then like went on to something else. I said, geez, you think they'd be more inquisitive? I mean, it's really, and I mean, my husband sees like the month plants have different colors. It's really interesting.
Wow. That's really neat. I find that when people perceive things as differently, it is so interesting, because there's a really wonderful doctor, Dr. John Rady, who wrote the book, The User's Guide to the Brain. And he says, you know, it would be more important for a clinician to ask, how do you perceive the world, rather than how do you feel? Because it's so individual. Because all our nervous systems are, you know, we're wired so individually. The third, the sensory-based motor disorder, this is probably one of the most widely accepted, because it's been something that OTs have recognized for a while. And this is where your nervous system, either through your postural patterns or through your ability to motor plan your responses, has difficulty with the response part of the sensory processing. So there's those three main categories, and what OTs do is through an assessment where they're observing and talking to families and talking to teachers and looking at which of the environments does a child function best in and what are the characteristics from a sensory perspective of that environment, and how about approaches? You know, which person does this child respond best to, and what is it about that person's approach? How do they use their voice? How do they use their body and their position? You know, do they wear a lot of bright colors, etc.? And then the third main category would be, what specific activities could you use throughout that child's day to give the child the opportunity to kind of reorganize their nervous system?
Oh, that's really important.
Oh, yes. And I mean, we all have sensory diets, but we don't call them that. Like, we call them coffee breaks, or we call them going out for a walk. But basically, we all know what we need. And as an adult, and we have a lot of control over what we do and when we do it. So we can really help manage our nervous system and our levels of arousal. But for children, it's a little bit tougher, because they're still learning about themselves and what they need and how to ask for what they need. So to have people in their environment that are aware, it could really be helpful.
Yeah, and I think what happens a lot, and I'm sure you see this, is that people think their child has a behavioral problem when it's really a sensory issue. And I see that, you know, I always wonder, like, if you see a kid at a store having a tantrum or something, I always think, oh, maybe they're just overtired or hungry. And then I think, well, maybe they're just overwhelmed, and then the parent's yelling at them, and that's not helping. And it just makes me sad. You know, maybe if they understood there's something going on. What are clues that parents should look for in order to get their child assessed, if they think it's beyond just, you know, a cranky, tired child?
I think most of the parents go from a very functional perspective, because as a parent, you're concerned about how much sleep is your child getting, how are they eating, how are they getting dressed, how are they doing in school, how are they playing with their peer group, etc. And when you see that a child is having difficulty with any of those areas, or often parents see a kind of a theme. So they'll see that, let's say, school and going to the shopping mall and getting together with the family for Thanksgiving dinner, all those result in very disorganized behavior. And I like to use the word disorganized, because that's really what it is. The nervous system's having such a hard time just making sense of things. So parents usually see this pattern, and the first thing they do is, without knowledge of sensory processing, is they look at their own parenting style. What am I doing right, and what am I not doing well? And then they try to change that and talk to their family doctor, talk to their child's teacher. And, you know, they go through their tools. If their tools don't work, then they seek out more information. And that's when they usually come to an OT or a PT with this kind of training.
I see. Yeah, that's what, when my daughter was a baby, she would hear every little sound. She was very alert. And when the wind would blow on her face, she would cry. And I mean, just little things, you know, but it wasn't right until she was 2 and a half that we actually took her. Somebody finally said, you should go see an occupational therapist. Yes. You know, and right when we walked in, she's like, oh, yeah, she's definitely sensory defensive. And then I didn't really think about my mother, which is so ridiculous because she would spend 2 hours a day in her room in the dark because she was just so overstimulated by everything. We couldn't cook with spices and she didn't like to walk on grass or go to the beach because of the sand. And I didn't even really connect it. And then I thought, oh, my goodness. So I'm just wondering if there's a genetic component.
Well, that's what's being looked at. And there are studies, mostly, I find the best research is coming out of the U.S., and there are people looking at genetics, the study of twins and the study of, you know, multi-generation, working backwards from characteristics back mm-hmm. to the genes. But to my knowledge, there's not been, you know, a specific marker found. That's just to my knowledge at this point. But, you know, you often see, especially in sensory defensiveness, children also and adults having a bit of anxiety that goes along with that because they're always on guard. When is that terrible, noxious input going to come? Mm-hmm. And especially for sound and smell because they're pretty invisible. You can't predict them like you can predict the other senses.
Oh, that's true. Oh my gosh. I'd say that my daughter has a bionic nose and apparently I'm extraordinarily smelly and I'm sharing that with the world because I shower every day. But to my daughter, I mean, honestly, I don't know what it is, but like she's very honest. You know, she'll come up to me and she'll say, Mommy, I love you, but you're extraordinarily smelly. And I'm like, yeah, I know, you tell me about 20 times a day. And my husband, he's the same way. He doesn't tell me that, luckily, but he also has a bionic nose. And my mother was like that, too. So it's definitely interesting. I definitely think there's a genetic thing going on. Mm-hmm. Maybe I could do my own studies. They should study my family.
Well, you know, I do see a lot when I'm doing assessments in the clinic, a lot of parents will say to me, that was me when I was little. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, but now I do this instead. And often with adults, there may be very similar challenges, but we've figured out ways to get our needs met very functionally.
Yes.
So we may actually have a job where, let's say we are movement seekers, then the job that we seek, we might be a fireman or an arborist or, you know, a gym teacher, something like that. So we've figured out what we need and even intuitively been attracted or chosen a profession that enables us to feed our nervous system with a sensation that makes sense.
Well, that's so good to hear because I'm sure a lot of parents in my situation, I kind of worry about my child. Like I'm here right now to, you know, after she comes home from school, we take an hour of quiet time. She won't sleep, but it's dark. The room is darkened and we just sit and we sing songs or we chat or what about her day or whatever, you know, and I need to do that for her because her preference would be just keep going all day long. But then, of course, she'd be up all night with like a lot of kids.
Exactly.
So I think I think to myself, well, I hope that when she's older, she can kind of modulate this herself. And it sounds like that's what's happening. I'm sure that's a relief to other parents, too.
Well, you've really found something that works for you.
Yeah.
And the neat thing is that, you know, you figure that out and then you can vocalize it to your daughter and say, this is what your nervous system needs. And I really think it's important to educate children that have sensory processing disorder so that they can all advocate for themselves. If a teacher says, you know, if you don't sit in that seat, then, you know, you're not going to be able to go out for recess today. And mm-hmm. teachers are doing their best, and they don't have training often in sensory processing in their own education. But then a child can say, I would love to be able to sit, but my nervous system needs to move. So how can I move and still, you know, be functional at this task? So to actually enter a dialogue. And, you know, I think that's because we can't always be there with them. So the more they understand about their own nervous system and to let the teacher or let the, you know, the Girl Scout leader, whoever, know that they are trying their best, but their nervous system needs something a little different. It's pretty enlightening and
it really
I think
is.
Empowering.
Yeah, you know, I'm so glad you brought that up. How do you start that conversation?
The best way I found is that there are a series of books out, Future Horizons and Sensory World carry them. One's called Sensitive Sam.
Oh, I love Sensitive Sam. Yes, I interviewed Marla. That was great.
So you could, you know, start with the book and then, you know, children are so intelligent. They often know themselves that their nervous systems are working a little differently. Maybe not that their nervous system is working differently, but they work a little differently than most. But it kind of opens up the conversation. And, you know, as an OT, I always really encourage parents and teachers and other OTs in the practice to always say, your body looks like it needs, or your nervous system looks like it needs a break, instead of you look like you need a break. Because it's, you know, oftentimes if we use the word you, it reflects on the person's effort and their desire to be successful. And it's really, this is a little bit within their control a little bit and a little bit out of their control. So by saying, you know, your body looks like it needs a break, is saying to them, I know you're working hard, sweetie, but your body needs a break to reorganize, and then we can get back at it again.
Oh, yeah. You know, I wanted to recommend two other books. I interviewed Hartley Steiner. This is Gabriel, Making Sense of School. And Linda Farrington Wilson is Squirmy Wormy, How I Learned to Help Myself. And yeah, there's some great books out there for kids. Again, I worry about the kids that are being labeled as troublemakers or you can't sit still. Yeah. I mean, what can we do for teachers? I mean, have you done it? Do you ever do any workshops for teachers to help educate them about these issues?
Yes, all the time. And with teachers, teachers are very creative people. And given the information, it's almost like another tool in their tool chest to look at how they're seeing behaviors. But if a child, for example, the first thing is environment. So how can you set up the classroom for that, let's say, a child who's actively seeking out a lot of movement? Well, they can have their desk right near the door so that they can just get out into the hall and jump 10 times and come back to sit down at their desk without disturbing anybody. And, or they can have a move-and-sit cushion on their desk, or you can tie TheraBand around the legs of their chair so that they can bang their feet up against it. You can teach them how to give their desk hugs or to do sit-ups on their chair. There's so many little strategies that we can teach children, and then they can use them independently without disturbing the rest of the class.
Oh, that's great.
You know, the major thing for teachers is they want their students to be successful. But what happens is they have however many, let's say 20 to 30 students that they have to move, you know, through a curriculum. So if they can do that while and still enable this child to get their needs met, well, then everybody wins.
Paula, this has been so informative and interesting. And again, I really encourage people to check out Building Bridges. You're so warm, by the way. You have such a nice way about you. And you're located in Toronto, is that correct?
Yes, yeah, I'm located in Toronto, and I do lots of workshops in the States through Sensory World. And Lisa, I just wanted to say that your daughter is very lucky that you're her mom.
Oh, thank you. I do the best I can for my little gal.
Yeah, that's
she's
the best we all can do.
She is a cutie,
it was really
though.
Great speaking with
yes,
you, too.
Yes, it was you. Now, do you have a site, Paula, that you'd like to give?
We're actually just building it.
Oh,
so
okay.
Maybe the next time we talk,
yeah,
it'll
definitely.
Be up and running.
Yeah, I'd love
okay.
to have you back on. And if people want to reach me, they can go to www.itsyourhealthnetwork.com. You can watch It's Your Health TV, listen to It's Your Health Radio, check out me on KKZZ with Freeman Michaels in Ventura County, where I do a show once a week. We're also doing a positive parenting series. And Paula, I'd love to have you on. I'll get in touch with you about that. That plays in Ventura, California and worldwide online. So I hope everyone has a great week. Thanks so much. Paula,